This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. In the United States, the 117th Congress gets underway today, and the U.S. House of Representatives elects a new speaker. Democratic incumbent Nancy Pelosi is running unopposed. Pelosi is the first woman in U.S. history to serve as House Speaker, and she has signaled that this would be her final term as Speaker and possibly her last term in the chamber. She is 80 years old. To assume the role of House Speaker, a member must receive 50% of the vote, plus one. Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, lawmakers must vote in person in this new Congress. And Americans closed the door on the 116th Congress, which managed a government shutdown, the impeachment trial of the president, and the deadliest pandemic in a century. Looking to the week ahead in U.S. politics, control of the U.S. Senate will be determined on Tuesday when voters in the state of Georgia head to the polls in two Senate runoff elections. The outcome will have implications for President-elect Joe Biden's agenda. Two Democrats will need to defeat two incumbent Republicans for Mr. Biden's party to take control of the Senate. So far, only 3 million early votes have been cast in Georgia. And the new U.S. Congress meets Wednesday to officially count the votes cast by the Electoral College. There are 306 for President-elect Joe Biden and 232 for incumbent President Donald Trump. And then we move forward to the inauguration of the president on January 20th. In Brazil, the number of wildfires increased 12.7% last year to a decade high, according to official figures. This will likely add to pressure on the president over the destruction of the Amazon rainforest. This is VOA News. U.S. officials on Sunday defended the stumbling campaign to vaccinate millions of Americans against the coronavirus, saying they expected much more to be done in coming weeks. Top U.S. scientist Anthony Fauci told ABC News that the glitches were understandable in such a massive vaccination program and that he's hopeful because 500,000 people are now being inoculated a day, a far better number than when the program started last month. Some 4.2 million Americans have received initial doses of the two-dose vaccines from Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna, but that is far below official predictions of 20 million by the new year. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams told CNN that part of the problem is that the virus occurred in the midst of a surge and that the local healthcare workers who would have administered the vaccines were already treating sick COVID-19 patients. President Donald Trump has placed the onus on states to orchestrate vaccine distribution once they receive their supplies. He tweeted on Sunday that the vaccines are being delivered to the states by the federal government faster than they can be administered. And in other news related to the pandemic, Egypt, which is the Arab world's most populous country, approved the use of a vaccine developed by Chinese pharma giant Sinopharm. The first batch of 50,000 doses of the vaccine was delivered in December, with another 50,000 expected this month, after which the inoculation program will kick off. Zimbabwe imposes a national lockdown with immediate effect following a surge in COVID-19 cases, creating a major problem for most citizens who rely on the informal employment sector. The Southern African nation is already struggling with a deepening economic crisis, hyperinflation, and high unemployment. Saudi Arabia announces the reopening of borders and the resumption of international flights after a two-week suspension aimed to stem the spread of a new COVID-19 strain in Britain and other countries. The European Union says it is ready to help drug companies expand coronavirus vaccine production to clear a bottleneck in distribution, with the EU Health Commissioner citing a worldwide shortage of production capacity. And a Japanese media report says a 29-year-old man has been arrested after allegedly breaking into the Tokyo residence of the Japanese emperor. He's not been named, but he reportedly spent 2 hours in the residence before he was discovered. For more stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We want to see how we can activate the farms that are owned by our member churches, so that they could produce at a commercial level, so that we can use those resources to provide the food for the communities in the future.
The Zimbabwean Christian Council feeds about 9,000 citizens facing hunger.
Our goal is that every Ghanaian in home must have, you know, laptop, must have a device, must have a new smartphone. We are even prepared to provide free smartphones to people to use data as part of the project.
A Ghanaian company partners U.S. companies to provide internet Wi-Fi services to citizens across the country.
The arrest portends a very bad and troubling signal for human rights in 2021. It is unfortunate that the Buhari administration, with appalling human rights records, has decided to start this year in this inglorious manner.
And Nigerian human rights groups threaten legal action over the arrest of former presidential candidate Omoyele Sowore. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Zimbabwean Christian Council has launched a program to feed the underprivileged affected by a recent surge in hunger. The group says about 9,000 residents of Masvingo and Midlands provinces continue to benefit from the program. Officials say the program forms part of the group's effort to combat food insecurity due to the global coronavirus pandemic. Some Zimbabweans, however, are expressing concern that the distribution of food could help with the spread of the disease. This after a report of a surge following what experts say could be a second wave of infections. To learn more about the food distribution program and its prospect, I reach Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mtata, General Secretary of the Zimbabwean Christian Council.
We are right now in the peak hunger period for those areas that were affected by the last drought. And that's why we have intensified providing food to those affected areas. We are actually providing food to nine provinces, focusing especially on seven districts. And we are also scaling up our feeding, especially for the under fives, where we have now changed from the basic nutrition provisions giving to a bigger feeding basket, because they are the age groups that get affected because of this hunger. We are worried, of course, Peter, that even we are having rains for those small plots that have been planted. Some areas are already starting to show signs of waterlogging. This is worrying, because then people will not be able to have a good harvest, even though we may have had good rains.
How is your program funded?
So much of our resources have come from the United Church of Canada, being itself sponsored by the Canada Food Grain Bank and the Canadian government. They have provided support for us in Masvingo and Midlands provinces, covering three districts of Bikita, Gutu, Chirumanzu, assisting about 9,500 beneficiaries, hopefully up to the period when they are going to have their next harvest, around March and April. We are also providing food for the under fives in Mashonaland and the East, so that we support in the prevention of malnutrition, Peter.
Do you have a plan, or does the church group have a plan to expand this program to other areas, particularly knowing that this is a hunger period, even through the Christmas and New Year festivities?
So in terms of the sponsorship, much of it is coming from our ecumenical partners, that is the church-related organizations that work with their own big donors that are providing us support for this humanitarian response. So, for example, the United Church of Canada, working with the Canadian Food Grain Bank and the Canadian government, have been sponsoring our feeding assistance program in Masingo and Midlands provinces, covering the districts of Bikita and Gutu and Chirumanzu, where we are assisting about 9,500 beneficiaries, hoping up to the harvest period. We have also been getting support, especially to target the under fives in Mashonaland and East, to address the challenges of malnutrition. We have also been working in the other five provinces where we have been receiving support from the Canadian Embassy, mainly to respond to the challenges to the effects of COVID-19 on the livelihoods of the communities that are generally self-employed, whose livelihoods were affected because of the lockdown. This covers also the districts of Matabeleland. In Matabeleland, we have Gwanda, Bubi, Marsh Central, Midlands, and Manicaland. These are the areas that we are covering from the support we are getting from the Canadian Embassy.
Reverend Tata, how sustainable is this program?
The sustainability challenge remains, Peter, because when you are getting your resources from others, they have their own priorities according to the changing needs in the world. So far, we are going to be running this feeding program, hopefully to the next harvest period. But we are also working on a sustainability program ourselves. We want to see how we can activate the farms that are owned by our member churches so that they could produce at a commercial level so that we can use those resources to provide the food for the communities in the future without depending on the only on the donation.
Reverend Dr. Kenneth Mtata is the General Secretary of the Zimbabwean Christian Council. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Dr. Prince Kofi Kluger-Singh is known as the father of technology and was the first to bring American companies to Ghana, including AT&T. He is partnering with major U.S. companies, including Facebook and Cisco, to launch a project aimed at advancing technology in Ghana. In part two of my interview, he tells me that the current project, which will be launched early this year, will include providing Wi-Fi access to all Ghanaians throughout the country.
Our first priority we want to do, which we are doing right now, is that we want to make sure that every home in Ghana has a smart television.
Right.
Every home in Ghana has a Wi-Fi, no matter how small it is.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major problems in Ghana is that it's a cash economy. So we're trying to reverse it to the U.S., to the international side, where people can subscribe on a small, small monthly basis. How do you give, the students in Ghana today a laptop with unlimited data for a month for 2 or 3 years so that their parents can pay small, small, they can be able to do their job? Those are the kind of things. As a result of that, a major factory is coming up right now to for the first time in Ghana and maybe in Africa, assemble, smart television backed by Google, laptops, tablets, smartphones, and other electronic gadgets, which is happening now at the time of Free Zone Enclave.
Mm-hmm. Before you go on, a lot of people have expressed concern that internet price ranges here are so expensive compared to the West. With this new technology you're talking about, with the factory that you established, how do you resolve this major challenge?
The goal now is that when you move to digitalization, which we are doing, the values dropped. The data values drop. Because of analog situation, you have to dig the cost of deploying it It's very expensive. Right. You have to dig the ground, lay the cables, mm-hmm. come to you, or whatever it is. But with the wireless situation, which is all about cloud now, every time your guys in America, they're always launching some satellite, you know, right. satellite do something. So we are hoping to be able to bring the prices down about 25% or 50% wow. if we can. As a result of that, you know, most of the partners that we have believe in the vision that we are trying to deploy. As a result of that, we are really getting value for money and a really, really good, if we have a smart TV that I'll be showing in a minute, with a Google, has a smart TV that has a Google Assistant already pre-installed on it. We have the franchise license already for Ghana and Africa. Mm-hmm. We are the only ones today.
Mm. You talk about Ghana and Africa. Do you have any plans with these U.S. partners that you have, this big technology companies, to branch out to the rest of the continent?
Yeah, that is the vision. Here will be, you see, Africa has 54 countries.
Right.
So, you know, companies like Cisco, Google, they cannot be in all the 54 countries or Microsoft and so. Because, you know, and the countries are not that big. If you look at West Africa alone, you know, I mean, between here and Liberia, Sierra Leone, they're not that far, you know, just a hop you are there. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the cloud, you know, transmit and receive, we have about 300 million customers in this corridor alone, you know, in West Africa.
Right.
So there's no need. So as a result, we are already working in Liberia, Sierra Leone, all the companies that can, because what we are doing is a world smart city project, reorganized, you know, as a smart city project, mm-hmm. Which has to have a handshake with government and also the digital assemblies. Yes, we'll bring the data prices down. Our goal is that every Ghanaian in home must have, you know, laptop, must have a device, must have a new smartphone. We are even prepared to provide a free smartphones to people to use data as part of the project.
Right.
One of the things that has come to which we just found out, we didn't know that, you know, the even me of all this age, I didn't know that the church economy is so major.
Right.
You know, major. The church economy is really major.
Right.
Our interaction with the churches today has realized that has opened a lot of our eyes, you know, to where, I mean, a lot of our pastors, a lot of them, if you see their profiles, very well educated, MBAs, mm-hmm. PhDs, you know. So one of the things we are looking at, that how do we be able to transform the churches or the auditoriums to teaching and learning centers as well?
Dr. Prince Kofi Kluja-Singh is the founder and executive chairman of Celtel Networks. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Human rights groups in Nigeria are criticizing and threatening legal action over the arrest and detention of former presidential candidate and publisher of Sahara Reporters Omoyele Sowore, who was picked up by police officials during a candlelight procession he held against bad governance on New Year's Eve. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Activists at the procession who managed to avoid arrest say police arrived at the Abuja protest venue in seven vehicles and got rough as they rounded up Omoyele Sowore and several others. Police have not commented on the arrest that has drawn criticism from human rights groups. Ario Dare, who works for the Center for Liberty Nigeria, says cracking down on critics is not a good way to start a new year.
The arrest portends a very bad and troubling signal for human rights in 2021. It is unfortunate that the Buhari administration, with appalling human rights records, has decided to start this year in this inglorious manner.
Another human rights group, the Socio-Economic Rights Accountability Project, SERAP, issued a 48-hour ultimatum Friday for Sowore's release and is threatening to sue the government. Sowore is a former presidential aspirant and leader of the Revolution Now movement, a growing political group often criticizing bad governance. In August 2019, he was arrested and detained for calling for a revolution in Nigeria. Authorities accused him of treasonable affront on government and have been monitoring him closely since his release in December 2019. But activists like Dari reject the labeling, saying it is inconsistent with Sowore's demands for better governance and that government is only being intolerant to criticism.
The interpretation being given to revolution now is totally unbecoming. There is nothing treasonable about the word revolution. We had agricultural revolution, economic revolution.
Nigeria has grown worse in its ranking on human rights violations since the Buhari administration came to power in 2015, according to Civicus, a human rights activist group. Buhari promised Friday to listen more to critics this year during his New Year address to citizens.
Your voices have been heard and will continue to listen to you. These ongoing challenges will be faced head on with renewed determination and with all the appropriateness and urgency required.
Activists say Shore's arrest is a contradiction to the president's New Year pledge. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Cameroonian President Paul Biya says new collaboration between the military and civilians has greatly brought about peace in the troubled English-speaking regions of the Central African country. Biya, in an address to the nation, pledged to pardon separatist fighters who laid down their weapons and renounced violence, and called on Cameroonians, whom he accused of sponsoring terrorism, to stop destroying their nation. For VOA Moki, Edward Kenzaka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
In a message broadcast on all local radio and TV stations, Cameroonian President Paul Biya said for over 10 years, his country has faced several external threats. He said the incursions of rebels fighting to topple the government of the neighboring Central African Republic is causing untold suffering among civilians on Cameroon's eastern border. Biya said that although Boko Haram's ability to attack on a large scale has been drastically reduced, the Nigerian-based terrorist group still remains a menace to civilians in northern Cameroon, where kidnappings and suicide bombings have been rampant. Biya said the most dangerous security threat the country is facing is in the western regions, where separatists are fighting to create an English-speaking state out of the French-speaking majority country. Biya accused fighters of beheading civilians, killing children at school, and torching public buildings. He said such crimes are a shock to human consciences.
Tous les coupables seront recherchés sans relâche et traduits devant la justice.
He says his military will relentlessly hunt all the perpetrators and make sure they are brought to justice. He says he is happy that public opinion, particularly in the two English-speaking regions, have now realized that the so-called separatists are actually nothing more than murderers and murderers of innocent children. Biya congratulated the military for what he said was a significant reduction observed in the activities of separatist fighters. He expressed his gratitude to the population for collaborating with the troops by reporting suspected fighters hiding in local communities. Biya said it has been difficult to completely stop the fighters because of support, he says, that comes from Cameroonians living outside the country.
C'est le moment pour moi d'en appeler une fois de plus.
Biya says he is appealing to all friendly countries to help stop the massacres in Cameroon by bringing to book all suspected sponsors and the organizations financing and running armed gangs in English-speaking regions of his country. He says a majority of those sponsoring the killing in Cameroon are hiding in Western countries. He says it is the wish of Cameroon that all those identified at the end of investigations as initiators or accomplices be punished. Cameroon has always accused Western countries, including the United States, of harboring sympathizers of the separatist crisis. Separatists have described Biya's message on social media as a non-event and said they will fight until they achieve independence. General Valenka is commander of Cameroon troops fighting the separatists in the English-speaking northwest region. He says while Biya's message was being delivered, Cameroon's troops were battling separatists.
You have to continue to clear camps to make sure that all those amber generals are neutralized and that the population will live in peace.
Nkrumah did not give the number of casualties but said the raids on a few separatist camps were successful. 18-year-old student Elizabeth Shuri, who fled the fighting in his northwestern village of Komti Yaoundé, says many people are affected by the deepening conflict. He says Bia did not consider their plight in his message.
I have a little one in the house. She is 7. She has been in the house for 3 years. It is difficult for her to read, to write, or to even speak fluent English.
Most girls are no longer in school. We have a lot of teenage mothers, girls who have been forced into early marriages, girls going out of the region as IDPs.
Besides the crisis, Bia also blames COVID-19 as one of the impediments to the country's development in 2020. Cameroon reported its first COVID-19 case in March. The government says 27,000 people have been affected with about 500 deaths. Bia said the separatist crisis and COVID-19 were the main causes of Cameroon's 2.6% economic growth rate in 2020, down from the projected 5%. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Meanwhile, hundreds of trucks are parked in Cameroon because drivers have stopped shipping goods and humanitarian assistance into the troubled Central African Republic in the face of violence following the December 27 general election. Again, for VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroon capital, Yaoundé.
Ajaizo Bukar, a 51-year-old Central African Republic truck driver, says he has been in the eastern Cameroon town of Garoua Boulay, impatiently waiting for the security situation in his country to improve. He says several hundred CAR and Cameroonian truck drivers cannot cross to the CAR capital Bangui because of fighting between CAR government troops and rebels.
Nous sommes au niveau de la sous-préfecture de Garoua Boulay. La situation est bloquée.
He says for about 2 weeks now, at least 700 trucks have been unable to enter the CAR from the eastern Cameroonian border town of Garoua Boulay. He says drivers are parking their trucks wherever they find space that is safe from thieves. He says some drivers and their assistants lack drinking water, food, and toilets. Bukar said most of them are transporting humanitarian assistance, food, and other goods from Cameroon's coastal city of Douala. The CAR government says violence was reported in several parts of the country before, during, and after the December 27 presidential elections. The CAR had accused former President Francois Bozize of organizing a rebel alliance to disrupt the general election. Bozize's candidacy for president was rejected, and he is accused of organizing rebel attacks, asking for the vote to be postponed until peace and security is restored. On December 25, Cameroon said more than 80 CAR troops crossed into Cameroon when fighting intensified there. Cameroon said its military pushed back an attempt by CAR rebels to enter its eastern territory. Bukar says the fighting has completely disrupted his business.
Le responsable syndicaux a essayé de faire maximum possible, mais c'est insuffisant.
He says they have so far received food, aid, and water from the Association of Cameroon and CAR truck drivers, but that the assistance is not enough. He says they are pleading with the Cameroonian government to help the drivers because the situation in CAR is getting worse and no one knows when the fighting will be over. A crisis meeting of truck drivers, the military and Cameroonian authorities was held Saturday, January 2, to find ways to help the drivers. Moïse Vokeng, president of the Cameroon Professional Transporters Network Association, says they have ordered their trucks not to enter the CAR until peace returns. He spoke via a messaging app from Douala.
We have first of all decided to stop moving trucks towards the Central African Republic due to that war there. You know, within 2 or 3 weeks, our drivers are abandoned, sleeping under the trucks, and the situation is very sad. So we are now expecting that with the collaboration of the custom here in Cameroon, we'll find spaces such as Bolloré, Spark, at Belabo to offload, and at least liberate some lorries and the workers who are suffering so much.
Cameroon said it provided space in border towns for the shippers to store goods until the situation in the CAR improves. Cameroon also said its military was keeping watch on its eastern border with the CAR. Vokeng pleaded with the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in the Central African Republic, also called MINUSCA, to help protect drivers transporting humanitarian and perishable goods from Garoua-Boulaye to Bangui. The Central African Republic depends on the Douala seaport for about 95% of its goods and humanitarian aid. Much of the election material, printed in Europe, was brought into the landlocked country through Cameroon. MINUSCA forces protected some of the material and election observers when they traveled from Garoua-Boulaye to Bangui when rebels threatened to stop the polls. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Simbuga and music from our African collection. But first, in Sudan, citizens have been commemorating the second anniversary of the start of nationwide street protests that began on December 19, 2018, and led to the overthrow of longtime military ruler Omar Hassan al-Bashir in April 2019. The demonstrators also protested recent political development in the country and demanded better living conditions. As we look at the country's transition to democracy, Sudanese analysts say the year 2020 has been rowdy for the country, with key successes and major challenges that will carry over into 2021. For VOA, Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
Ismail Ibrahim is a professor at the Institute of African and Asian Studies at the University of Khartoum. He says Sudan's transition is faced with challenges, none more pressing than the economy.
The most pressing challenge, that is the living conditions of the people, you know. The rise in the poverty, level of poverty, the cost of living is just, it's becoming terrible, unbearable. And unfortunately, it is related to the lack of the basic necessities, the food and cooking gas and all the oil necessary for the transportation, whether that's gasoline or benzene or whatsoever, you know, you call it, you know, the petroleum products, you know. And the most, I mean, disappointing thing that there is no prospect, there is of a constructive policy formulated by the government so that could improve the situation, you know, unfortunately.
Months of protest led the military to oust former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir after 30 years in power. The protests were led by the Forces of Freedom and Change, a coalition of political parties and professional associations which now shares power with the military. Ibrahim says a rift in the ruling coalition hampers Sudan's transition.
The problem is also compounded by the rift within the ranks of the coalition that is for freedom of change. This coalition that is supporting the government and it is formulated the government has reflected badly and negatively on the ability of the government, you know, to come out with a constructive policy to address, you know, the difficult economic situation, you know.
Key transitional government institutions have yet to be established, most important among which is a transitional National Legislative Assembly. Since August 2019, Sudan has been governed by a military-civilian government. At the top is a sovereign council with 6 civilians and 5 military generals, and a civilian cabinet or council of ministers led by Prime Minister Abdul Hamdok. In this first half of a 39-month transitional period, the head of the sovereign council is General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, backed by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is in charge of a paramilitary force known as the Rapid Support Forces. Samah Salman is a strategic and economic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association in Khartoum. She says central to the economic crisis is the control of the military and the rapid support forces over Sudan's economy.
Together, they control about 80% of the country's economy through a lot of the companies, both public and private companies. So you have the gold sector, the livestock and slaughterhouses, and petroleum. Most of these companies are actually owned by the military. And so unless the military agrees to give up control of the most of Sudan's financial resources, they will continue to have the upper hand.
Sudan faces its worst food security crisis in recent history, caused in part by months of devastating floods, a COVID-19 lockdown, and hyperinflation. The United Nations says nearly a quarter of Sudan's population is severely food insecure, while the inflation rate hit 270% last month. Salman notes that Sudan's transition, however, has not been without successes. Key among them is a peace agreement signed in October between the government and a coalition of rebel groups. She says the government needs to work hard to bring on board holdout groups that have not signed the peace deal. Another success is that the United States dropped Sudan from its State Sponsors of Terrorism list, or SSTL, after 27 years.
And then the U.S. agreed to provide the IMF with $1 billion in order to help Sudan clear its arrears to the IMF and to open doors for direct foreign investment. In fact, I had a call with the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, which is the private sector arm of the World Bank today, and they expect that by end of this coming January, Sudan will be open to foreign direct investment, which is fantastic news. So it looks like things are going quite smoothly in this respect.
The move came after Sudan agreed to pay $335 million to compensate victims of terrorism attacks by Al-Qaeda in 1998 and 2000. Sudan was accused of providing support to the terrorist organization. Salman and others say Sudan also has taken important steps to expand civil rights in the country, preserve women's rights, and criminalize the practice of female genital mutilation. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The African Nations Championship Tournament, CHAN, kicks off on January 16th in Cameroon, but many are hoping that COVID-19 doesn't disrupt the tournament. Zimbabwe's final preparations have been dealt a blow after 9 of the 23-man squad tested positive for coronavirus just as the last leg of their camp began. The Warriors had taken a Christmas break and returned to camp on December 28th. The 9 players who tested positive have now been isolated from the rest of the squad until shortly before their departure for Cameroon. Zimbabwe are in Group A with hosts Cameroon, Burkina Faso and Mali. They are scheduled to face the Indomitable Lions in the tournament opener on January 16th. Meanwhile, the Malawi Blantyre Derby has been called off because of COVID-19. The 67th Blantyre Derby for the 2020-2021 Malawian Super League was postponed due to a coronavirus outbreak in the camp of Nyasa Big Bullets Football Club. The defending champions Bullets and rivals B Forward Wanderers were set to meet on Saturday, January 2nd at Kamuzu Stadium, Blantyre. And Zambia's Chipolopolo made the early trip to Cameroon last week to take part in a four-nation pre-tournament friendly in Yaoundé as preparation for the African Nations Championship CHAN. A 27-member team that left last Wednesday will take part in the friendly tournament that involve fellow CHAN finalists Niger, Uganda and host Cameroon before moving to their Group D base in Limbe, where they will face Tanzania on January 19th, Guinea on January 23rd, and Namibia on January 27th. Meanwhile, the second edition of the Sudan Women League kicked off last week with a limited supporters' attendance. The opening game saw Hilal Al-Obeid defeating Mod Al-Obeid 7-0, while Ahly and Nogam Al-Salem had a 1-1 draw. The 2020-2021 season includes 23 teams divided into four groups in Khartoum, Obeid, Kadogli, and Wad Madani. In athletics, IAAF boss Sebastian Coe has reiterated that there's cast iron determination to stage the Tokyo Olympics. Coe also called for athletes to take their place in the vaccine queue. He said healthy athletes should take their place in the COVID-19 vaccine queue behind people with more pressing needs, despite events such as this year's Olympics looking said to be highly dependent on competitors arriving free from the virus. Most athletes in their 20s and 30s would be just about last in line in most countries when it comes to the vaccine, but the pressure to create a COVID-safe environment at sports events has raised the question of whether they should be treated as a special case. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah. Shaki.
Yeah, they try to toast me. I'm married to the game, but the game don't love me. It'll leave me in a heartbeat. That's why I'm cold-blooded. When I say I love you, I mean it deeply. I can't see life without you living with me. And if you love someone, I know you feel me. When I say before they take you, they gonna have to kill me. I'm talking they gonna have the Army, Marine, Navy, steal me. Yeah, the world knows this, but babe, you know the real me. I play any hand that they deal me. So tell the dealer he gonna have to deal with me. Even when you're gone, I'ma hunt you like a Chris Webber timeout. So to the sky comes crashing down, world falls apart, till death do its part, you my heart for sure.
Habibi, I love you, I need you, Habibi.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if you want to swallow a mango seed, you first have to calculate the diameter of your anus. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.